Welcome to My Life Chassidus Applied, episode 483. This program is dedicated by Jacob Benjamin and Aviva Shalem in loving memory of their father Binyamin Yaakov Ben Chana Gurji, who passed away on the 25th of Shvat, 5782. So let's begin with living with the times, which means the time of the year we're in, the chapter of the Torah we're reading. This is how the Jewish people, from the beginning of time, have always gathered and found strength as they traveled through their journeys, all the ups and downs of life. What gave them power and strength and confidence was the Torah that traveled with them. And it traveled with their calendar as well, the holidays, the different seasons, the different months. Because you see, time is energy. And when you can tap into the energy of a particular time, it's a tremendous resource, both in giving us guidance and direction, as well as empowering us. And this is something needed at all times. In all years, in all generations, in any given period in history. But especially when we're facing unique challenges, we're fighting battles, life and death. As we speak, soldiers on the front lines are sacrificing their lives to protect innocent men, women, and children. And throughout the world, you see the upheavals. You see Jews again in the news, anti-Semitism on campuses, in so many other places. There's many good things to report. We're living in unprecedented times of freedom. So we're not just self-made individuals. We come along with tremendous resources. Our parents, our grandparents, our ancestors, our history, our tradition, our legacy, and the Torah that travels with us. So we are now at the end of the month of Shvat, going into the month of Adar, the happiest month of the year. It says, "Mishenichnas Adar marben b'simcha." As Adar enters, we increase in joy. And this year we actually have two Adars because it's a leap year. A leap year, 2 months of Adar, which will begin next Friday and then go for 2 months. It's also the week of Parsha Mishpatim, which we just began reading and learning, following the chapter Yisrei in the book of Exodus that talks about Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, greatest event in history. And that is followed by this week's chapter, Mishpatim, which literally means the chapter of laws, continuing the laws that were given, the mandate, the moral, ethical laws given to us to live up to our greatest potential in fulfilling our mission in this world. So both these things, the time that we're going into the month, as well as the chapter, give us strength. So let's talk about a few of those general lessons and then get into more details with many of the questions that come in from you. And here is a good opportunity. Chassidussupplied.com is our website where you can ask any question at our forum anonymously, confidentially. Nothing is taboo, nothing is off limits. As you see, we've been doing this program now for 483 weeks. It's been quite a journey. And the questions continue to come in. So thank you for that. You can also find other resources, Chassidus Applied resources, at chassidussupplied.com. So let's begin with Adar, the month of Adar. Mishenichnas Adar marben b'simcha. Which means, as I said, time is energy. So every time has its particular disposition, its particular predisposition. Which means like the mood of the time, the energy of the time, the vibe. And this vibe and this energy is one of joy. But joy is a word that is a three-letter word, but it has a lot more meaning than many people think. It's not just being happy and joyous. It's also about a state of being. It's a sense of purpose and belonging, which means even when there are difficult times, you can also be joyous. Joyous does not mean frivolous, does not mean superficial. It means there's a sense of urgency, and you're committed to it, and there's always a joy connected to that. So if someone were to ask the question, how can we be joyous? With a war raging in Israel, is it appropriate to increase in joy during the month of Adar? The answer is absolutely. We need it more than ever. Joy is not escapism. Joy is not denial. It's not. Joy is a sense of higher purpose. It's a sense of confidence that whatever part of life that you're going through, even if it's difficult, you have tremendous strength. We'll talk about that some more shortly. So this month provides that. When you see soldiers go to battle. So of course there's the fears, there's the concerns, there's the unknown, there's the dangers. But they still go with a joy. They still march, a victory march, knowing confidently that we're fighting the right cause. We will prevail. God is with us. So though some of it may include painful situations, loss, death, casualties. But overall, it's a joyous cause. So again, joy does not always take the shape that you're dancing at someone's particular celebration. It's a general attitude to life. And that's why we're told, serve God with joy all the time. But you'll say all the time, there are times when we're sitting Shiva, God forbid, someone lost a loved one, or we see a tragedy. So yes, then the joy is not expressed in the most external way of dancing and singing. It's much more internal. But there's still a joy that you're here. You're the survivor. You're the heir. You're carrying on the legacy of the person that's passed on. And you have a commitment to that. So you can cry with joy as well. And it's, again, not a contradiction. So when we say Mishanichnas Adar Marvin B'Simcha, we're saying we're entering into that period. The fact that there's another month that says Mishanichnas of Mamayitim B'Simcha, we diminish in joy. That's not a contradiction to not serving God with joy. It doesn't say stop serving God with joy. It says we diminish in the outer expression of joy. And in Adar, we express it in a far more revealed way. But obviously, if something negative or tragic happens in the month of Adar, we recognize it. There's actually a fast day right before Purim. A fast day is not a day of eating and drinking and celebrating in the conventional, you know, through a party or so on. It's not partying. But there's still gilu birada. Even in serious days, there's an element of inner peace and inner harmony. This is where I need to be right now. And even being somber or being serious or being sad can also be part of the mission. So it's not about this expression, it's about the very feeling you have. So even sadness, you're serving God. When a person's crying over the loss of a loved one, and unfortunately we've had to cry over quite a few loved ones in the last few months, tragically. So yes, you're not celebrating like you're celebrating at a wedding, but you're still celebrating because you're fulfilling your mission. And now your mission is one where you need to cry. So joy is more than just a verb, it's a noun, it's a state of being. And that's the power of Adar, even in times of war. It gives us that strength. Regarding Mishpatim, the chapter that we're reading this week. So Mishpatim, as I said, means laws. There are three names for the mitzvot, for the commandments in the Torah. One is called Chukim, Eidus, and Mishpatim. Chukim refers to the super rational laws. Laws that, if God had not told them, no person would ever come up with it. Things like Shatness. The red heifer, Zeus Chukas HaTorah, is maybe the ultimate expression of that. Eidus means commemorative mitzvahs. They're witnesses, Shabbos, Passover. They remind us, they are honoring an event that happened that day or that period in time. So it's like a witness to historical events, commemorating, but reliving, more than just commemorating, reliving it. So it's rational, but it's still connected to a particular, I don't want to say completely super rational, but it's not like the rational mitzvahs, mishpatim is purely rational. Do not steal. Do not murder. Things we could have come up with, even if we were not told in the Torah, because it's part of, makes total sense. Now, all the mitzvahs are all connected to something that's super rational, and even the super rational have rational explanations. Mishpatim teaches us that even when you're dealing with the laws that are rational, that human beings would come up with moral laws, sensible ones, always know they're still connected to Sinai. They're still connected to a God. I am your God that gave you this mitzvah. Because to have that type of moral absoluteness and not moral relativism, you need to connect it to something higher. It's not based. Because if you go by logic, logic one day can dictate that maybe under these circumstances, these laws don't apply. And we've seen how subjective and how horrible things turned when people did that. Take World War II, take the Nazis. They justified the most immoral behavior. So Mishpatim teaches us we have to join the two. When you're fighting a war, war's blood is bloody, it's painful, and innocent people die. So that's why it's so critical to connect it to a higher cause. Why are you fighting? Are you fighting because someone hurt you? Are you fighting out of vengeance? Out of anger? No. You're fighting because that's the cause. And now the cause that demands that you need to protect the innocent people after such an attack. When people are calling for your death, it's your moral imperative is to fight a war. Not because you want to fight. We actually don't want to fight. So it gives you the moral conscience. It gives you a clear conscience and a moral compass to do what has to be done. And just like I said before with joy, it's not whether what shape it takes. Sometimes it takes a difficult shape. Sometimes it's very painful. But you're doing the right thing. And if you don't do that, if you don't defend the innocent, like they say, those that are kind to the cruel will be cruel to the kind. If you appease enemies, they will ultimately hurt you. So what's more peaceful? And what's more correct to do? Sometimes you have to do something that may not be easy to do, but that's what's necessary. And that's why you need to turn to God and accept and say to God, tell me what is the right thing to do, not just what I think is right. And when you have the answer to that, then you're going not just with yourself, you're going with God's strength and with God's clarity, and you'll fight only as much as you need to fight. And you won't succumb to your own particular whims for vengeance or other things like that. That's why Mishpatim is such a vital thing. It combines the rational, but knowing the rational is built on foundations of the super rational. So lessons that we learn from this time period. Okay. So let's go a little more into the month of Adar. What do we learn from the month of Adar, and especially the two others in this leap year? So now let's talk about the leap year. What everything I said till now is every year Adar. A leap year this year is a leap year. So a leap year is an interesting paradox. On one hand, it's an additional month. And not just an additional month, it's an additional month of joy. So you have like double the joy, double that deeper connection that brings to ultimate joy, sometimes revealed joy, sometimes more discreet joy, but all a joy from based on that connection that we were talking about, when you're connected to your purpose. So it's double. On the other hand, why is it a double? Is because it's coming to compensate for something that was lacking. The reason there's a leap year, basically every 19 years, 7 years are designated to be leap years, is because there's a discrepancy between the solar year and the lunar year. The Jewish calendar is run and controlled by the lunar calendar, meaning by the cycles of the moon. When is Rosh Hashanah, the new moon of Tishrei? When is Sukkot, the 15th, the full moon of Tishrei? When is Passover, the full moon of Nisan? When is Purim, the full moon of Adar, which is usually the 14th, 15th of the month? That's why these holidays, respectively, Sukkot the 15th of Tishrei, Passover the 15th of Nisan. So they would sanctify and designate when is the new moon, In the olden days, it was done through witnesses. Today, we have it all calculated. They calculated back then as well, but they needed a confirmation, affirmation from witnesses. Then it was designated the new month. And that would already designate the holidays, when the holidays were, based on when the new moon is. And there are many reasons for the moon. The moon represents the Jewish people. It goes through its phases, waxing and waning. It represents bittul, element of humility. So that seems all fine. 15th of the new moon of Nisan would be Passover. But then the Torah tells us Passover should also be designated in the spring. Chodesh Aviv. In Israel, that's the beginning of spring. But here comes the problem. The seasons are established by the solar cycle, not by the lunar cycle. The days of the month and the months are designated by the lunar. The lunar cycle is around 11 days and some hours shorter than the solar cycle. So the solar is 365 days a year. The lunar cycle is approximately 354 days. So if that's the case, okay, so the first year would be fine. 15th of Nisan is the spring. The next year, the 15th of Nisan will be 11 days earlier. Okay, it's 11 days is not that much, but the next year, 22 days, 33 days. After a number of years, Passover will end up being in the winter. And for a few more years, it'll be back in the fall. And before that, it'll be in the summer. After that. And then back to the spring. So how do you deal with that? So the sages derive from that that there needs to be a reconciliation. That they calculated that every, if you add an extra month of approximately 30 days, every 3-4 years, or 7 times in 19 years, you rebalance it. So the 30 days of the lunar, it's an extra lunar month, that compensates for a little less than 3 years of the deficient 11 days, and there you keep the balance. So Passover will always be in the spring. And the same thing with the other holidays. Okay, that's the technical. What does it mean on a spiritual level? On a spiritual level, it means that the lunar cycle and the solar cycle represent two different energies. The lunar cycle represents the energy of change, of growth, of rebirth. The solar energy represents consistency. Now, in life, we need both. We need foundations that are consistent and unwavering, but we also need growth. We need change. So we're told, bring them both together. We want to have the best of both worlds. For example, the Gregorian calendar is only a solar calendar. The Muslim calendar is only a lunar calendar. And in Judaism, it's a combination of both, a lesson of balance, having the consistency of the sun while also having the change and growth of the moon. But what do you derive from this? That even though it's two Adar's additional month of joy, but it came because of a deficiency. Now, why is there a deficiency in the first place? Because we're told that in the beginning of creation, God created two great luminaries, the sun and the moon complained. Can't have two crowns of one king. Or two kings to one crown. So God said, so go diminish yourself. So the diminishment of the moon is considered a negative thing. To the point that God even says, bring atonement for me from diminishing the moon. And we're told when Mashiach comes in the future, the moon will reclaim its original glory. So the moon has its strengths, but it also diminishes. It waxes, but it also wanes till it disappears, and then it's reborn. So on one hand, it's a great experience. You're able to fill the deficiency with an extra month of joy, other. But on the other hand, it's rooted in a deficiency. So this goes further and teaches us that even in a time of deficiency, we have hope. We have ways to compensate. So even during a time of war and a time of setbacks and losses and tragedies, we know we can rebuild and be reborn again. So the sun just talks about consistency. The moon enters a world where there are times there's deficiency, there's pain, there's loss, there's diminishment. And yet it's reborn with the power of the sun, because at the end of the day, in the language of Kabbalah, it's Yichud Shimshe V'Sira, the unification between the sun and the moon, between these two forms of energy we were discussing. So the 2 months of Adar help us also apply to our lives today. Now that answers another question that was asked, were the Rabbeim more concerned during a leap year? So we're told that the Rebbes, the Rabbeim, the Chabad Rabbeim especially, came to a leap year, Shana Muberes it was called. Muberes means a pregnant year. It's pregnant because it has an additional life, additional month. They were concerned, they were always concerned because of the deficiency. Because the Miut HaLavona, the diminishment of the moon, reflects, as Chassidus explains, all the diminishments in existence. The diminishment of the moon evolved from the shattering of the containers of Tohu, which in turn evolved from the Tzimtzum Arishon, the great Tzimtzum of the divine concealment, the paradigm shift that allowed for the space for existence, but the divine is concealed. And in turn, the diminishment of the moon led to the Chet Eitz Hadas, the eating from the tree of knowledge, the sin. So the diminishment of the moon is connected to all forms of dissonance. But the objective is always the dissonance, the disconnect. The diminishment is meant to bring Tzimtzum b'shvil ha'gilui. The concealment is in order to bring even more revelation, even more strength, even more power. And that's why Shehem Asidin is Chadash Kamesim, that the Jewish people be renewed, reborn. But we do go through times of diminishment. We go through times of challenge. And that's where the Rebbeim were concerned during leap year. So it's interesting, this war broke out right at the beginning of a new leap year. Tovshin Pei Dalet, 5784. Now we're about to enter that month that's added in order to compensate. So we have both sides, the deficiency that happened, lives were taken the most tragic way, but we're guaranteed through Adar that not only will we fill in the gap and the vacuum and the emptiness, but we'll be filled with joy, with a double joy. Because every deficit, every descent is meant to bring a greater ascent. So now a little more details with that question about is it appropriate. So someone said like this, is there a concept that during a leap year with two others, we have to double the amount of joy? So we explained, yes, absolutely. Would the optics be bad and make us look insensitive if we made many joyous parties here in New York and other places while our brothers and sisters in Israel are suffering, fighting a war? Or because it says, we still have to go out and do our job and be extra joyous. So I answer the question. The answer is no. To make ourselves a business as usual and ignoring what's going on, absolutely not. On the contrary, precisely what's going on in Israel, and precisely because we have full faith and trust that we will prevail, we dance with them. And you see the pictures, the videos, the images coming out from Gaza, from the war front. You see them dancing, joy in joy. That's not ignoring. It's not denial. It's not escapism. It's a part of one of the ways we actually gain strength. We celebrate our being Jewish. We celebrate the Holy Land of Israel. We celebrate that God has chosen us. And we even celebrate that we have to defend and protect our lives and the Holy Land. We, of course, prefer... but we wouldn't have to go to war and would not have to have any casualties and not losses and no hostages and so on. But while we're doing it, we do it with tremendous joy. So joy is not a contradiction to difficult times. It's part of the strengths we gain and muster and get empowered with in order to fight those challenges. So that's the way we have to look at it. And we have that double joy that we have this year. Did the Rebbe ever say that there's a better chance Mashiach will come during a leap year than a regular year because he has an extra month to come? Is it more likely for Mashiach to come in a leap year? The Rebbe definitely spoke about the 2 months of Adar joy, and Mashiach's connected to joy, Simcha Selim al Resham, there'll be complete joy then. Today it still has to be tempered. Oz Yismol Ismech Shek Pinei. And then when Mashiach comes, our faces will be completely with joy because it will be revealed on all levels. So when you have 2 months of Adar, you have 2 months, yes, you have more chance. I don't remember an exact sicha talk from the Rebbe, but I say this to the listening audience. If anybody does have an actual source, and it's very likely that there is one, I'm not suggesting there isn't, it just doesn't come to mind right now. Please share that with me, and I'd love to share it with everyone else, especially as we go into the month of Adar. But the concept definitely makes total sense, and especially when we know that the reason, the question is asked in the Talmud, when do we celebrate Purim? Because everything usually is celebrated in the first month of Adar. The second month is the additional one. So you would think Purim should be done in the first month. The Gemara says no. Mismach Geula LeGeula. Being that the second month is closer to Pesach, and Pesach is a month of liberation and redemption from Egypt, so Mismach, you associate in two consecutive months, making them Geula Dika months. So the second month is when we celebrate Purim. But still, in the first month, there's a symbolic Purim Katan, which tells us that the first month also has some form of Geula. But the full Geula of Purim is celebrated, should be adjacent with the month of Nisan. What you see from this is that these months are connected to Geula. So when you have 2 months, and then going right into Passover, and we know that B'Nisan Nigalu, B'Nisan Asidin Le'Goyel, in Nisan we were redeemed and we will be redeemed in the future. It's called the month of redemption, which means that we don't have to wait till Nisan comes. Like the Friedrich Rebbe explains, L'shana Babi Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, doesn't mean we have to wait till go to Jerusalem next year. We go this year and automatically we'll be there next year too. So Mismach Geula Geula is not just a line that you're connecting Purim, that Geula can be also in the month of Adar, and then automatically month of Nisan will be Geula as well. So we have more time for this to happen. That doesn't mean we want to wait. It should happen immediately. It should happen even before Adar. Mashiach Achak Le B'chol Yom She'yoveh. Mashiach can come right now, month of Shvat. You don't have to wait. But those months are more auspicious, more opportune, more conducive to the Geula energy. But Geula can happen and should happen any given moment. So that answers that question. Good. Yes. So now let's move, since we're still coming from Chav Beis Shvat, it was the 36th anniversary of the Yahrzeit of the Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka. So there was one question that came in afterwards, but let me just, to tie it up, let me just ask that question. The question was, what did the Rebbe say about the Rebbetzin's ability to bless others? And what can we learn from that? Okay. So, to read the full question. Dear Rabbi Jacobson, in relation to Chav Beis Shvat, I heard a story that someone was in the Rebbe's house and asked for a bracha, a blessing, and the Rebbe pointed to the Rebbetzin and said, you can ask her, she's also able to give brachas. The man asked the Rebbe, is there a difference in the brachas? Meaning between the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. And the Rebbe answered, if I give a bracha, you have to make a keli, a container for the bracha. If the Rebbetzin gives a bracha, it comes from a much higher source, and you don't have to make a keli, a container. The bracha is fulfilled automatically. So my question is this. If that's the case, then if we go to the Ohel, should we just go to the Rebbetzin to ask for a bracha because it's guaranteed to be fulfilled? If we went to the Rebbe, we would have to make a keli, and there's no guarantee we will make the proper keli at the proper time. Okay, so firstly, I can't vouch for the story because I didn't hear it firsthand. I've heard rumors of similar stories, but I like to be careful, especially speaking here in public. And for the record, it's important to really be accurate. So if anyone does have more information on these stories and actual real direct sources, please share that with me and I will share it as well. But I mean, let's assume the story is correct with all the details, also the difference, which again needs a source because it's a strong statement. The difference, and why is it different? Why is the Rebbe's bracha not automatic, and why is the Rebbetzin doesn't need a keli? It begs explanation. I can explain it. If I knew the story was absolutely right, I'd find ways to explain it. But being I'm not so positive, I'm not trying to throw any aspersions or any cold water on the story. I'm just saying I don't have it accurate, so I don't know if I should push myself now to explain the difference. But regarding your question, in general, there's a concept, for example, difference between bracha and tefillah. So Chassidus says that bracha and tefillah, a blessing and a prayer, you could say it's very similar. You ask someone for a blessing, bless me, or you ask them to pray for you. So Chassidus says the difference is this, a bracha is drawing down, meaning the blessing is destined for you. It's already there, but it hasn't been drawn in a revealed way. So the one who's giving you a blessing is helping draw it down. The mile of that is, what's the quality of that? That's definitely yours, and you're definitely destined to have it. What's the, now I don't say negative, what is it lacking? It's not a new, it's not a new channel. It's a channel that's already yours. That's why by Ephraim and Manasseh, when Jacob blessed them, he crossed his hands. Even though Yosef put Manasseh, the older one, on the right side, she's older, she get the right, the blessing from the right hand, which is a more powerful blessing. And Ephraim on the left side, he crossed his hands because why couldn't he just give Manasseh the blessing that the firstborn deserves? Because he saw this was a bracha. He was giving a bracha, not a prayer. And as a bracha, he saw this was destined for Ephraim, so he put his right hand on Ephraim. This was destined for Manasseh, so he put his left hand on Manasseh. Tefillah is a hirotzen. It can actually create a new destiny. That even though this has been designated for you, you can change that. You can increase it. You can eliminate something that was supposed to happen that wasn't positive. So tefillah introduces a new unprecedented energy, not revealing something that's already in store for you. The mile of that is clear because it's a completely new energy. What is the lacking? It's not guaranteed. Now, bracha is yours. It's already been designated for you. That doesn't have to be created. So it's far more assured that you'll receive it. Now, I don't know if this is what the Rebbe was alluding to. So in other words, making a keli for a bracha has a big mila. Because firstly, it becomes integrated, it's internalized, and it's something that is assuredly yours. A bracha that comes from above, you know, maybe you can, God forbid, squander. You haven't made the proper keli, maybe not sustainable. On the other hand, a bracha that comes from above needs less effort on your part. So to say that one is without the other, no. It's not about how easy it is. You want to have both milas. You want to have a bracha that's also a tefillah and a tefillah bracha, or in this case, a bracha that makes a keli and a bracha that is higher than kelim. That would be some explanation if indeed, as I said, the story is accurate. Regardless, the explanation is correct because it says chassidus. But associated with this story, that's what I'd like to find out if how accurate the actual story is. But it also explains why we need to have, you want to have a bracha from the Rebbe and the Rebbe. And the Rebbe's. Talking about promises and blessings, another question came in like this. Since God can do whatever he wants, how are we guaranteed that God will fulfill his promises? The way it was phrased was like this. If we say God is infinite and can do whatever he wants, why do we say that we're guaranteed that God will fulfill his promises? If we are saying God can't change his mind and not fulfill his promises, isn't that putting limitations on God? And since we don't want to put limitations, he can do whatever he wants. He may not fulfill. Well, the answer to that, my friends, is this. The same Hashem that can do whatever he wants, that same God told us, Im b'chukeise telechu, v'smitzveise tishmeru, v'nasati gishmeichem b'itam. Follow my Torah, my mitzvahs, and I will give you reward. The rain in its time, gashmechem, the word gashmias. In other words, there's an idea of schar and enish, the idea that there are positive implications and consequences from our good behavior. Hashem put that in place. So just like when it comes to nature, is God bound by the laws of nature? Of course he can suspend nature anytime. But after the Mabli, he says, lo yishbeisu, I will not suspend them. And even when I suspend them, I'll do it as much as possible in nature. That's why you see Kriyas Yamsuv even. Absolutely supernatural miracle. Parting the waters. And they can walk through them. That's not something that happens every day. It's a miracle. But even that didn't just happen. God could have just said, walk on water or walk through the water. He sent the wind and the wind caused the waters to rise, as we read 2 weeks ago, two Shabbosim ago. Why do you need all these things? Because as much as possible, God respects the structure and the laws of nature that he himself created. We say a shidduch is as difficult as parting the sea. Why is it difficult? For God it's difficult. For us it may be difficult. It's not difficult to part the sea. Yes, it's difficult because God bound himself to these laws. And on that level, it's kavyochel, so to speak, a difficulty. Because he doesn't want to suspend his own laws. Remember, those laws come from the same kol yachol, the same absolute immutability and amniability of God doing whatever he wants to do. And that same God says, this is what I'd want. And that's why we can rely on his promises. And every promise will be fulfilled. It may not always be fulfilled in the way we see immediately, but it will be fulfilled because God promised it. It's not a human promise. And God said, I'm not committed. He committed himself. And remember, his commitment comes with the same intensity as his ability to be beyond everything. So basically, that very ability that God can do whatever he wants, he's now directed and says, and I'm doing it by promising you this, and I will live up to these promises. Okay. So here's a bunch of other questions that came in connected to the war. We've covered a lot of different angles over the weeks, over the months. And I did so also on other programs. We have a whole website, we have a whole landing page with a wide array of materials, all war-related questions and issues. Some of them are far more compelling, especially in the beginning. They're all compelling. So there's a series of questions that came in about how to approach, what should be our approach to the Muslim world. So I want to address some of these questions. And obviously, we're always with the goal of practical application, not just theories. So the first question, are they our sworn enemies? We see in the constitution of Hamas and in other statements and written materials that they're calling for the annihilation of all Jews from the river to the sea. They don't hide that fact. Can I say all the Muslim countries? Not necessarily, but there are some that definitely. So what are you supposed to do with that? Not believe them? And then they've acted on it. Look what happened October 7th, what we call Shmini Atzeres. Or what they call October 7th, I should actually say. And it's not the first time we've seen terrorist attacks and so on. So there are particular approaches when you know that. We're not dealing with a neutral entity. We're dealing with a sworn enemy, someone who's declared war. Someone declares war in the United States, declares war on France, on England, on any country. There are certain things that go into place when you declare war on someone. You declared war back. You have to defend yourself. Again, not because you want to, but because your enemy has forced you to do so. But let's go into a little more detail in this. So someone wrote the following. Hi, Rabbi Jacobson. I have a question based on your open letter to the Muslim community. So last week we published a letter that I wrote. And you write, he says, quote, some argue that you silently condone and agree with his behavior. Others say that you may not advocate this violent approach of creating an Islamic caliphate. This is me writing to the Muslims. That some say you silently condone and agree with his behavior. Others say that you may not advocate this violent approach of creating an Islamic caliphate. I would prefer that it be done peacefully, but you can understand and therefore tolerate your fellow Muslims who do embrace these militant methods. End quote. So this person is writing like this. While I applaud your hope for a bright future, it does seem like your head is in the sand. This is him writing to me. Islam teaches in the Quran about world domination. It teaches that Muslims should invade countries and make them Islamic. All methods through lies, deceit, and the sword are permissible. You're looking through the lens of Torah or Judeo-Christian Western values, but it's foolish to judge others by your own values and not by theirs. They also have the doctrine of taqiyya, or hiding their true intentions for the purpose of achieving their religious goal. Thus, I don't understand what you gain from this letter. Even if Muslim leaders would mouth these words, the words you want them to say, it will just be taqiyya, lulling you into a belief that you can deal with them and that they are reasonable when they are anything but. The only thing Muslims understand is strength and the threat of swift violence and punishment if they don't follow the law. Then while they may not agree, they may obey. Thank you in advance for addressing this. Okay, and thank you for these words. And we're talking bluntly, candidly, without any gloves. So let me respond. My letter was not coming from a naive place. It was coming to expose exactly this. This is what you do. Let's put everything on the front lines. If you really don't believe in it, tell us and address also this issue of Takiyah. Maybe you're lying. You know, we all know what Hitler said to Chamberlain. Yes, peace. But we all knew it was a lie and didn't take much time to find out. But it's better to talk about it than to ignore it. Expose it. Challenge them. There are Muslim countries who want to have a relationship with the West for business purposes, for PR purposes, whatever it may be. I mean, some signed the Abraham Accords. What do they really think? Do they not want to sign those accords? Do they just want to benefit but then attack Israel when they can? Are they serious? Are they sincere? Are all countries the same? This needs to be addressed in a very direct way. That's exactly the conversation. I'm very glad you're writing what you're writing. Because I agree, this needs to be brought up as well and challenged. I'm not coming to any conclusion to say that the Muslim world is all ready for peace and just a few wild terrorists. No. Just as in Germany, not everybody acted like a Nazi, but there was plenty of complicity through silence. And silence is consent and complicity. This needs to be addressed. This needs to be brought to the table and stop the games. Qatar officially is negotiating. Is that really their position? Or they actually sponsor the terrorists, sponsor October 7th, and then make believe that they're negotiating. Expose them for who they are. And at times, diplomacy may be, let them play the game as long as you get what you want. That's also part of battles. So this needs a lot of wisdom. The point is, let's talk about it openly. So I'm not suggesting, I mean, it's ridiculous to suggest that those that are calling for the destruction of Israel and the Jews don't mean it. We know exactly what they mean. So let's not be naive at all. But I think calling the Muslim world on it, especially with all the propaganda out there, because there are millions of people who are neither Muslim, nor anti, nor pro, but are confused, and the propaganda is influencing them, let them see. So even though the Muslims themselves may, let's say they're all correct, you're right, they're all against and ready to do whatever it takes. But is everybody in the world that way? Let's expose it. Let everything be clear. One of the worst things is confusion, especially in time of war. That's why you need intelligence, because there's all kinds of deception and decoys and lies. As Churchill said, in the time of war, the truth is so precious, you have to surround it with an enemy of lies. With an army of lies, sorry. The truth is so precious, you have to surround it with an army of lies. And that's what we need to clarify. You want to know exactly where everybody stands and stop with this whole confusion and so on. The book of Daniel, Yizbaru v'yislabna advarim, Mashiach's times will be, let's achieve and find clarity. So it's very important to bring all this out into the front lines and let everybody stand and say exactly where they stand. And as I mentioned many times, and here's where my hope is, being that all human beings were created in the divine image, and being that they all are children of Abraham, so we have to fight our wars, and we can't be naive, and we can't let our guard down. But the hope is that they will be tamed. Remember, the Christians were very violent for many, many centuries, for most of their history. And yet they were tamed. The United States is a country built by Christians, not by Jews or Muslims. So why can't we believe that the Muslims too can be tamed? And part of it is calling them out on it. Part of it is also showing strength. So if I said, or anyone suggested, don't go to war, just talk to them. No. We understand that they understand, they respect and they will respond to strength. As a matter of fact, after the Six-Day War, you saw as much as they hated Jews, they were quiet. And they were afraid of a soldier. They trembled before an Israeli soldier. So it's very clear that strength speaks to that part of the world. So I'm not in any way minimizing that. But together with strength, remember, we're not just here to win, meaning to destroy the enemy, we're here to change them. And we want to change them. But you have to be wise and not naive. And that's part of the process and so on. Another person writes, is there room for reconciliation with them? So someone writes like this, another perspective, from a Lubavitcher Zionist, he writes, hi Rabbi Jacobson, I've written to you before, two of my kids, a son and a daughter, both serve in the IDF, that's the Israel Defense Forces, in combat units, and my youngest son is about to start commando training. I'm a Lubavitcher and a Zionist in the same way the Rebbe was an all from Idnar. I love Eretz Yisrael. My perspective is that our government was crazy in 2005, giving away Gaza to the Arabs, and now we are reaping the rewards, quote unquote. When your audience asks how long this war will go on, despite our Torah and mitzvahs, what they fail to grasp is that Hashem gave us the land and we threw it back in his face, so to speak, and allowed a well-funded terror organization to dig hundreds of kilometers of terror tunnels and infrastructure. Now it isn't so simple to just take it back. Of course, it would be more simple if we followed Torah's dictates and fought to eradicate our enemies, including non-armed combatants and supporters, from the land and retake the land. But our government, which is not a Torah government, prefers to sacrifice the lives of our soldiers in order to please the international community and doesn't believe that this is our land and we should possess all of it. We're in a royal mess, and it will be solved, of course, through Torah and mitzvahs when we elect leaders who value and what Torah teaches us over what the non-Jews, the Goyim, will say, and doesn't allow us to be so dependent on the Goyim for weapons, etc. Anyway, as someone invested in this war via the lives of my children on the front lines, I thought I would share that perspective. So, in that context, the question is, how many of our problems with our enemies are due to our own mistakes? And it's a sensitive question which really may not even be appropriate to discuss now when there's a war going on and we need to be unified. But like you just pointed out with Gaza, many mistakes were made. And the goal here is not to point fingers, but to learn from them and to learn how to approach it in the future. So as I said regarding the previous questioner, we need to be very clear-headed here. We need to know exactly the facts, including what we've done wrong. And yes, we need to have this strong position. I mean, the Rebbe, after all, was the visionary, built on Torah approach, not built because he was hawkish, as some say, or he was right-wing. No, that's the Torah approach, that you have to know who your enemy is. And when it's a sworn enemy, they don't have to be attacking you every second to be an enemy. That's why when they come to you Shabbos to discuss trade, kash v'tevin, we'll trade the resources, we'll trade supplies. And they're not armed even, but they're your sworn enemy. So you have to mobilize because it's on a border and it's danger. So there's no question that that is critical. And any mistake, anything less is a mistake. If we lull ourselves into thinking, oh, it's all fine. Not when you're dealing with a sworn enemy. So going back to the question, is there room for reconciliation with them? Yes, with certain conditions. If they would completely surrender, if they would completely change their constitution, and if they proved it in actions over time, then you know that changed. But so far, that's not happened. But the Rebbe was very much in support. Sign peace treaties, by all means, but don't give up land for that. Cultural peace treaties, economic peace treaties, like the Abraham Accords. But don't do anything that will put you in danger. Anything that's not reversible. Giving back land, and you have only a piece of paper that's a peace treaty. That's not appropriate, especially when you have dealing with enemies. Peace treaty, by all means, and indeed, may it work. May goodwill be created. May economic opportunity be created. And then in time, it only can intensify that trust. But it has to be based on those realistic parameters that we just laid out. And it's interesting that the Rebbe never spoke, as long as I remember, he never attacked and never called the Arab Muslim world, even though they were haters. That was not his focus. His focus is, what are we doing? Our destiny is in our control. What they are, they are. You have to do what you have to do with strength. And they'll come around based on how you behave. But if you behave with weakness, of course, you're going to be feeding them and empowering your enemy, which is what happened, unfortunately, after the Six-Day War. You have to have clear winner and loser in a war. And the winner dictates the terms. If you make the loser think they're a winner, it's a grave, that's a cardinal b'chiladeiris, irreversible mistake. It would be like the Allies telling the Germans, we already destroyed your city and Berlin, but we want you to save face. So it won't be unconditional surrender, it'll be conditional. Big, big mistake. What would have happened? They would have believed, oh, you know, we have some, and we'll rebuild. Based on their Nazi ideologies, God forbid. But the wisdom was unconditional. We dictate the terms, And today, Germany and Japan are allies of America, of Israel. So it's the strength that actually creates the peace, not the opposite. Is there legitimacy to Meir Kahana's approach of incentivizing Arabs to leave Israel? Or the way another person put it was this. Why, dear Rabbi Jacobson, why did the Rebbe not advocate, as Rabbi Meir Kahana did, to get the Arabs to leave the land? The Torah clearly states, "Vim loyser Yeshua sheishvi aretz mipnechem, v'ho yashu sisiru mehem l'shovim, b'enechem l'tzaninim b'tzitchem, v'tzor v'eschem al Yisrael asher itam yeshvim bo." Asher atim yeshvim bo. As we've seen over the years, I'll translate that. So what is the pasuk is saying as follows, basically. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before from before you, then those whom you leave over will be as spikes in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they will harass you in the land in which you settle. As the person continues writing, as we've seen that over the years, and in double measure on October 7th. So, I am not going to start making comparisons between Meir Kahana and the Rebbe. Meir Kahana also defied government, and he did things the Rebbe always wanted the government to change the position, and not that we, especially publicly, defy the government that has the authority. And other significant differences. But the idea of incentivizing, without not talking about battling, whether financially or other ways that Arabs should move, it's, I don't think the Rebbe ever said not to try that. If you can do it, maybe a very good idea. But that I would leave more to experts and so on. The point is, however, the Rebbe's approach was not about the Arabs. I go back to that. It wasn't about getting rid of them. Even though the Rebbe did speak once, 1960, at the end of 67, by Simchas Torah, Tov Shin Chof Ches, and after the Six-Day War, it was an opportunity, because of all the displacement anyway, that to move the Arabs out of Jerusalem, in the middle of war. So the Rebbe was very practical in this sense. We have to do our part to be strong. He wasn't getting into the details what you should do with the Arabs. And maybe off the record, the Rebbe would have said all kinds of things. I can't speak for that. But I will say this, that if you are strong in what you need to be done, what happens in the United States? You also have people who sometimes don't accept the laws of the land. They don't get a green card or they're deported. There are ways to deal with it. You could have a peaceful country, but you have to be strong and not compromising. And not in the back of your mind saying, really, I know it belongs to them. So even though we conquered Jerusalem, we'll give them back the keys. Like I said, you can't let a loser feel like a winner. They want to move out? By all means, no one's stopping them from moving away. So it's a little more complicated. I don't want to get into the actual strategies of how or what. Should you do that? Could you move the 2 million Gazans out of Gaza? No country wants to take them. Should we force them to take them? Maybe. Maybe that has to be part of a strategy. But as you understand, this is more complex and more comprehensive and needs a lot more detail. And it's not, here's not the place for me to go into that, because I don't know all the facts involved. I don't know all the circumstances. But that's the general approach. Okay. How do we address the hypocrisy of liberals supporting UNRWA? It's called UNRWA, the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency. So in more detail, someone writes the following. Evidence was found that some employees of the United Nations in Gaza were Hamas members that participated in the October 7th massacre. As a result, many countries started defunding the United Nations. The left-wing liberals are very upset and are saying that defunding is collective punishment. But these same extra leftists called for defunding major police departments after one police officer out of force of 10,000 did something wrong. But when it suits their politics, it suddenly is not collective punishment. It's not collective punishment. How do we explain such hypocrisy? How does the Torah advise us to deal with such people? Should we try to have conversations to show them their hypocrisy, or are they so brainwashed it's hopeless and it won't matter what we say to them? I think it's case by case. I think many are brainwashed and you have to choose and pick and choose your battles. Some impossible to talk to. I know, I've tried, I meet people and I see. But there are quite a few you could speak to. It's very infuriating because they have their own narrative and they just completely distort and lie. And there's always the consideration of serious anti-Semitism in there as well. That's why there's the double standard, which they'll never admit. They'll find all kinds of justifications. So you have to be wise where to spend your time. Should you spend time? We all know the hypocrisy. It's very, very clear. I mean, it's already been pointed out. You know how many people were killed in Syria? How many killed in Africa and other places even as we speak? Nothing close to what's going on in Gaza. You don't even hear about it. The UN does not protest. There are no condemnations. It's non-existent. I mean, why is there no unified effort about freeing hostages that were taken? Innocent men, women, and children. You don't hear anything from all these liberals. They talk about one person was killed, tragically, Floyd. What about the 1,200 or more that were killed on October 7th? So the people who choose and pick like that, I mean, it's so transparent that it's embarrassing. It's tragic, actually. But we never give up hope. If someone you know that you think you can communicate with, by all means. And I have nothing really to say. What am I supposed to say? I'm as upset and I'm disturbed as you are when I see such hypocrisies time and again. But, again, we have to look at ourselves. We have to deal with the battles that we have control over. We can't control everybody out there and how they think and how they their distortions. We have to be strong in our position, voice it, share it, disseminate it unapologetically. Yes, in a kind way, but in a persuasive way, in a firm way. That's our platform. That's what I've been doing. I have to say, I have thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, even of Muslims that listen to my YouTube programs and so on. How many people are actually changed their mind? I know some are thinking a little differently. Some have actually changed a little. That's not my point. My point is we still have to broadcast what we need to broadcast. And I learned this from the Rebbe. The Rebbe spoke, he didn't always think who's going to be influenced, not going to be. And the fact that someone does not get influenced or someone doesn't like what he's saying or criticize it doesn't change them. Emes. We have to continue sharing the truth. And focusing where we can focus best, that will have the most effect and impact. And we believe firmly, just as Avraham Avinu did almost 4,000 years ago, that Emes Yeda Darkei, the truth will show the way and it will prevail and it will conquer the world and transform it into a world of Geula Mashiach. That's what we believe, and we continue to believe, and we've seen it happen in the past. Principles that once were shunned by the world, rejected, that the Jews embraced, a very small minority in the world, have become now mainstream. Values that people cherish about freedom, civil rights, human rights, the very values of that many of these liberals consider so powerful, where did they come from? From the Jewish people, they don't even realize that. Those that bless you shall be blessed. And that's our approach to the whole picture. And we have to fight the wars that need to be fought without any hesitation. There are so many more questions that came, and I wanted to address especially a whole section I have on a lot of people been asking about Mashiach and the connection to all that we're talking about. What I'll do is perhaps I'll address the first question. Where someone asked, can you please explain the idea of turning the world into a divine garden? I think I mentioned Yitzvah time. I was speaking in different communities. And one of the talks I gave was titled, How to Turn a Jungle into a Garden. Obviously, when you see events that's happened in Gaza and so on, October 7th, jungle. But Bossi Ligani, how to turn it into a garden. And that's a good way to sum up everything we're discussing here. So turning the world into a divine garden. Hi, Rabbi Jacobson. I have a question based on... Reading the wrong question. Here we go. Is a point of the Bossi Ligani Maimer that Hashem gave us the seeds, i.e. the tools we need to plant and grow the garden, but it's our job to utilize the tools properly and make a nice garden for Him to want to dwell in. And possibly because it says, "Asuli migdash v'shachanti b'seichem," that there are two sorts of gardens, a personal and collective garden. So we each have to make a nice garden in our lives and let Hashem be revealed. Let Hashem be revealed in it. And additionally, the community works together to build a large communal garden for Hashem to dwell in, and that garden will ultimately be the Beis HaMikdash. Yes, that is a very accurate description. And that's the theme of Basel Ligani, which is the central theme of the Rebbe's leadership, as he assumed leadership officially in Tavshin Yud Aleph with the Maimer Basel Ligani, the last Maimer published by the Friedrich Rebbe, which is all about transforming the world and revealing the garden that it was in the first place, but now in a far better way when Mashiach comes. Which means taking a world that he says, Sheker, talks about the lies of the world, deception, how much more appropriate to the lies we see today. And from Sheker, make it Keresh. Krashim, Vasisili Krashim, the Krashim, the beams that hold up the Mishkan. Atzei Shittim, from Shtus of Lumaze, from the insanity, the demonic insanity of Klippa and Sitra Achra, of the negative that we see again in the world today, turn that into Shtus de Gdusha. Atzei Shimtim Oimdim, Shtus de Gdusha, a super rational commitment to good, to goodness, to kindness, to love, to godliness. And transform the world into Adira B'Tachteinim, a home for God in this world, a garden, a beautiful garden, which is more than just a home. It has the beauty, the pleasure. And who does it? Tzivos Hashem. The Maimer talks about army, soldiers of Hashem. Like we're fighting a war today. There's the military side of the war, and there's the spiritual side of the war. And what are we given? Bizbuz Ha'etzes, the deepest treasures that were always concealed and hidden, the high levels of divine treasures, are given to whom? To the front lines, to the foot soldiers that are fighting this battle. What more appropriate lesson to our times? We're fighting these battles. We've always fought battles, but here the battles are taking on shape as they are today. And we know for sure we will prevail. We will win. Midas HaNetzachin, the Netzach Yisrael, LeYishaker, the true victory, a total victory in the Gula Amitis Vashlema. And that's what we fight with, and that's what we believe in, and we forge ahead. So Hashem should protect all our soldiers on the front lines who are sacrificing themselves to protect and defend men, women, and children in Israel. Jews everywhere should be protected. The hostages should be released unscathed. And we should finally be zeich and merit to the end of this long nightmare and marathon with the Gula Amitis Vashlema. Everyone have a very Freilich Chedesh Adar Rishon. Shenichnes Adar Marbe Misimcha. The main Simcha is Mismach Gula LeGula. Simcha V'Gula Amitis Vashlema. And we should march into the Gula and here on only peace, permanent peace. Peace in the entire world. B'lo yareyu v'lo yashchisu b'chol harkotshi. Kimola Oriz Deyas Hashem Kamayim Liyom Mechasim. There will no longer be evil or destruction in this world. Al Harkochi, on this holy mountain, but in the entire world, because the world will be filled with divine knowledge as the waters cover the sea. And hopefully part of that is this work, My Life Chassidus Applied, trying to apply Chassidus to matters and issues of our time, including the battles of our time. Yefutzu Meinasecha Chutza, which will bring Osimar de Malka Mashiach. This has been My Life Chassidus Applied, episode 483, episode 483. We're here every Sunday, 8 to 9 p.m. A gut avach and a gut nechedesh, a gut tamid.
This program is brought to you by My Life Chassidus Applied. Please help us continue our programs. Make even a small contribution at chassidusapply.com/donate.